Studio 360 is supported by the Vilcek Foundation, dedicated to raising awareness of immigrant contributions to the arts and sciences, congratulating the winners of the 2013 Vilcek Prizes, Richard A. Flavell and Ruslan Medzitov in biomedical science, and Yo-Yo Ma in contemporary music. More at vilcek.org. And by Lumosity. How often do you lose your keys? Your wallet? You can spend hours looking for lost objects, or spend 10 minutes a day on Lumosity.com, the personal trainer for your brain. Improve memory and attention with scientifically designed brain games. Visit Lumosity.com now.
I was a highly successful writer.
He was a prolific, high-strung pulp science fiction writer who dreamed of making it big in Hollywood.
I think had he succeeded as a screenwriter and a director, his life might have taken another turn.
Instead, L. Ron Hubbard took some of his sci-fi ideas and founded a religion, Scientology.
Give him credit. He wrote more books than you and I will ever have the opportunity to read. He created a religion that somehow survived.
A religion, no coincidence, with a lot of believers in Hollywood. I'll talk with the author Lawrence Wright about his best-selling new book, Going Clear. And later, I pluck a couple of my hairs, spit into a tube to supply DNA to an artist who makes portraits based on your DNA data. That and the super hot British pop band The XX are all ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Lumosity.com, dedicated to helping people improve memory and attention with neuroscience-based exercises for the brain. It's all at Lumosity.com. And from the car company Scion. For their latest campaign, Scion gave cameras to five individuals who turned their passions into a profession. When following your passion, you live for every second to see your dreams become reality. See how they make every second count at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, an artist conducts a genetic experiment with my DNA. Really? Can she figure out what I look like?
Are these all from the same person?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. They must have very dynamic hair.
We'll find out more about that later in the hour. But first,
my name is Tony Mendez.
The movie Argo has already won a whole bunch of awards, and at the Oscars in 2 weeks, it's up for seven more. Argo, of course, tells the unlikely but true story of six U.S. Embassy employees who snuck out of Tehran while their colleagues were held hostage in 1979.
What I know is we need to pretend to be a movie crew. We go to the bazaar today. We fly out from the airport tomorrow.
We won't do it.
Ben Affleck directed the movie and also stars in the film as Tony Mendez, the CIA agent rescuer. And that casting has provoked some argument. Many Latinos in and out of Hollywood have questioned whether the waspy Affleck should have played Mendez, whose father's family came from Mexico. One prominent critic of the casting decision is Moctezuma Esparza, the CEO of Maya Cinemas, a theater chain in California and Texas. He's also been a movie producer of films such as Gods and Generals and the Milagro Beanfield War. Mr. Esparza, welcome to Studio 360.
Hi there.
So you've showed Argo at Maya Cinemas, your theater chain. Have you gotten feedback from Latino moviegoers about this issue of Ben Affleck playing Mendez?
The people that I know socially that I talk to have commented on my article and have told me that they very much agree with the sentiments that I expressed.
And in 50 words or less, what are the sentiments you expressed in that piece?
Well, a concern about the historical behavior of Hollywood, where it is okay to have non-Latinos, non-Mexican-Americans, play historical figures who are in fact Mexican-American or of Mexican descent. Given the fact that Latinos are the most underrepresented population in reference to acting positions in Hollywood, historically over the last 100 years.
And everything you've just said is, I agree, pretty much inarguable, but I'm going to play a bit of devil's advocate here because there are some sort of gray areas here. For instance, Tony Mendez was born here. He's Irish and Italian on his mother's side. He never learned to speak Spanish. Doesn't that, in the case of this particular historical figure, make this more complicated?
That's really not the issue. The issue is how does society see us? How has America seen us? And if you have a Spanish surname and you look like someone who might be Mexican, even if you don't, even if you're blonde and you have a Spanish surname,
Okay,
it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You're discriminated against.
Yeah. And the fact
that's what I'm addressing.
And the fact
I don't begrudge Ben Affleck's desire to play the role.
Right.
You know, as an actor, I get it. You know, I withheld my article until after the theatrical run of the movie because I'm part of the industry and I understand what a miracle it is to get any movie made, and I respect his achievement.
Right. So in the piece you wrote in the newspaper La Prensa San Diego, you said that the film could have been cast otherwise without affecting its commerciality. Really?
It's not Ben Affleck's performance that raises this movie up. It's the execution, the script, the story. And there were a whole host of characters in the movie where you could have cast around with other stars and had an unknown, if you wanted,
right,
in the role of Tony Mendez. That could be done. I've done that. That's not something that is difficult. It's something that's done and considered in Hollywood all the time.
One interesting criticism I read of Argo is that, in this context, is that the script obscures Mendez's ethnicity, that we hear his whole name other than just Tony maybe once. Do you have any reason to believe that wasn't deliberate?
It can only be deliberate. And it is part of the justification that the actor took, the director, producer, in being able to justify him being able to play the role.
What if, this is a hypothetical, obviously, but what if Affleck had made the movie and the script made it clear that Mendez was Mexican-American of descent? And
well, I would have felt better about it, but then it would have fallen into the category of Marlon Brando playing Zapata, Muni playing Juarez, you know, and that's better because at least we know who he is.
Right.
But it still speaks to the larger issue that Mexican-Americans and Latinos aren't getting a fair shake in Hollywood to create careers and become stars, particularly given that we're now representing like 35% of the national box office on any given movie on opening weekend.
And the fact is, I mean, people don't think of actors like Cameron Diaz or Charlie Sheen or Benjamin Bratt being in any sense Latino, but of course they are. So the fact that they have so fully assimilated, is that in this context a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, you know, you're listening to me. Do I sound assimilated?
Entirely.
All right, so then what's the point? What does assimilation have to do with bigotry and racism and historical exclusion?
It has something to do with it because people who are more assimilated are less excluded and treated with bigotry.
I would disagree with you having lived through it.
Right, right. Given that Hollywood is about making money, and as you say, this Latino population is a hugely important one and growing fast, why don't the people in power simply recognize that and say we've got to, not for any altruistic reasons, but say we've got to make movies by and about and with people from these backgrounds?
That's a good question. Many people have asked that question, and I don't think a satisfactory answer has emerged.
Yeah. Well, Moctezuma Esparza, I really thank you for talking with me today.
I appreciate your inquiry. Thank you.
Moctezuma Esparza is the CEO of Maya Cinemas and a former movie producer. You can find the article he wrote about the Argo casting at studio360.org. Let us know what you think. Should the Tony Mendez role have gone to a Latino actor? Go to studio360.org and leave us a comment. When it comes to raising donations for creative projects, the web-based Operation Kickstarter has become the place to go. This month, three movies that got money through Kickstarter are up for Oscars. It's only been around since 2009, but Kickstarter has already delivered over $400 million to various projects and taken its 5% cut along the way. A lot of you have probably contributed to friends' Kickstarter-funded dreams, but what happens if you give money to a project that never actually gets made? Ike Sriskandaraja has the story.
On Kickstarter, you'll find two kinds of people: creators pitching projects and backers supporting them. Last year, 2.2 million people pledged to fund projects on Kickstarter. Most of the backers had positive experiences, but for a few, it was less than rewarding.
It made me cynical. I don't think Kickstarter is a scam, but it sure could be.
Last year, Max Geller of Brookline, Massachusetts, donated to a public art project in New Orleans called A Giant Ball Pit in an Abandoned House.
I want to fulfill a childhood dream of mine and fill this entire space with these giant, soft, bouncy balls by the thousands.
Yeah, I thought this was something that I would contribute to.
About $15. 230 other people chipped in a total of $3,300. More than enough money to fill a skeleton house in New Orleans with bright, bouncy balls.
So thank you very much, and I'll see you in the ball pit.
But here's where one man's ball pit dreams run into zoning, safety, and people who just don't want a ball pit in their neighborhood. The city put the brakes on the project, and for many backers, $20 was not worth losing sleep over. But Max was more vigilant about his investment.
I mean, there's lots of fun things to do in New Orleans. There's plenty of reasons to go. And one of them for me was to get my money back.
1,500 miles later, Max found Josh Entee, the ball pit guy, and got his $15 refund. Josh has gone on to give refunds to more than half of his original backers. He sent out a lot of checks, and the rest got their money back through Amazon payment accounts.
I felt entitled. That's really important. I felt entitled to having my money back.
And Kickstarter wasn't going to get it back for him. When projects reach their funding goal, Kickstarter delivers the money, but it won't make refunds. So backers have to find their own solutions. Last year, the first Kickstarter lawsuit was filed when a backer sued a creator for not delivering the custom iPad holder that was his promised reward. Some high-profile flops have created controversy on the site. Deacon, a member of the band Animal Collective, raised $25,000 to make a record in Mali. He took the trip, he came back, and then 3 years passed without a word. To this day, no music, no refunds.
And the funny thing is, if you look at what he did, the only mistake he made is he dropped the ball on communicating with his fans.
Amanda Palmer, Dresden Doll and Kickstarter Pro.
If the communication had been ongoing and he had said, I'm not really happy with these mixes, I'm not really happy with this music, why don't we just call this a draw, I'll put one of my demos up digitally so you can hear what I'm talking about, and I'm going to give your money to charity. Are you guys okay with that?
Palmer knows something about communicating with fans. Last year, they helped her raise over $1 million for an album and artwork.
My Kickstarter grievance is probably a pretty rare one. But the toughest thing about my Kickstarter was after it happened, everyone thought I was rich.
With her $1 million, Palmer said she'd spent $200,000 on recording, $300,000 on distribution and promotion. But when it came time to touring, she did something she's done before and asked for musicians to come play for free along her tour route. This time, it brought a backlash. Fans, musicians, critics, people were angry.
It hurt. It really hurt my feelings to feel that misunderstood.
Still, she's in it for the long haul.
It's going to be a little while before I do another giant project, but I will absolutely use crowdfunding because there's no simpler way. So I'd happily use it again.
Because at the end of the day, it was a success. Most funded projects on Kickstarter don't fail. According to a survey from the Wharton School of Business, Kickstarter has about a 3.5% fail rate. Major funding like the NEA has about a 1% fail rate. So, not bad. But what happens to the money for the unbuilt ball pits and undelivered albums? I asked Kickstarter co-founder Yancey Strickler.
Every project is between its creator and its backer. It's the creator's responsibility to complete their project, and that's what they set out to do.
But let the backer beware.
Kickstarter is, it's where the creator and the backers meet, and it's our responsibility to make sure everyone knows how the system works.
Crowdfunding seems to be the latest thing, but it has an important ancestor, subscription publishing.
It was a way of distributing the risk and the cost for books or projects that were considered a little marginal.
Jason Ponton is editor of the MIT Technology Review, which has written about this.
Sometimes it would occur if the book were considered slightly risque.
For the quirky, the taboo, and the pornographic. But unlike Kickstarter, this model gave more insurance to the supporter. For instance, if something happened to the author or the work.
That happened on occasion. Books were not completed. The author died. The author changed his mind. He became a drunk, in which case the publisher was expected to return the money to the subscribers. And if he could not, he might be thrown into debtor's prison or sued by the original subscribers.
And Ponton thinks more lawsuits on Kickstarter are just around the corner because the site is ripe for a scam.
We've been warning that at some point in the not-too-distant future, an actual scam occurs with Kickstarter, where someone takes money for a project they have no real intention of delivering, and then the scammers, the fraudsters disappear. And the investors are going to look for someone to find responsible.
Is there a contingency plan or a conversation in-house at Kickstarter if that happens on a large scale?
Well, you know, I think that...
Yancey Strickler of Kickstarter.
As a company, and I think that the way you think about the community is just about the overwhelming majority of projects have gone very well. But I don't think anyone would expect that every project would go perfectly or that every project would work out. And that's just the nature of making things.
Kickstarter has grown by leaps and bounds over the last 4 years without protecting its backers. Because in most cases, it's not just a transaction. It lets backers feel close to the creators, feel like they're part of the process. And if you're the creator...
It's a kind of pick your poison. You can either choose to have a bunch of label people and middlemen and distributors cause you a headache, or your fans can cause you a headache. Either way, there's going to be a headache. I would rather have the headache directly with my fans.
For Studio 360, I'm Ike Sreekandaraj.
Ike Sreekandaraja is a reporter for Turnstile News, a project of Youth Radio. So have you used Kickstarter as a creator or a backer? If so, tell us how it's working out for you at studio360.org. And while you're there, you can hear Ike's uncut interview with Amanda Palmer and her take on the Kickstarter backlash. Still ahead this hour in Studio 360... Instead of dying, ship out to Venus to have your memories erased.
When you make a declaration that you believe in something that other people think is ridiculous, you step across a line into a community. And the more that group is persecuted for the absurdity of their beliefs, the more solidified in some ways they become.
The writer Lawrence Wright on his new book about Scientology. That's ahead in Studio 360. From PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the Vilcek Foundation, dedicated to raising awareness of immigrant contributions to the arts and sciences, recognizing Richard A. Flavelle and Ruslan Medzitov for their accomplishments in biomedical science, and Yo-Yo Ma in contemporary music. More at vilcek.org. Support for Studio 360 comes from Lumosity.com, dedicated to helping people improve memory and attention with neuroscience-based exercises for the brain. It's all at Lumosity.com. And from the car company Scion. For their latest campaign, Scion gave cameras to 5 individuals who turned their passions into a profession. When following your passion, you live for every second to see your dreams become reality. See how they make every second count at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Thank you to everybody who entered our latest extra credit challenge, Are We Alone in the Universe? We got more than 200 illustrations from you answering that question. You can see all of the funny and creative and weird submissions at studio360.org. Next week, we'll announce the winner. And speaking of imagining extraterrestrials, there's a lot of terrific science fiction being written nowadays, but as a genre, its first golden age was probably the mid-20th century, when space exploration and atomic energy and all the rest were new and bedazzling. One prolific sci-fi writer from the old days took his feverish imagining a big step farther. L. Ron Hubbard founded a religion, Scientology, which from the beginning focused on recruiting actors and other show business folk. And the story of Hubbard and his church reads like the most incredible fictional saga ever. Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief is the definitive new book by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and New Yorker staff writer Lawrence Wright. And he joins me now. Larry, welcome to Studio 360.
It's good to talk to you again, Kurt.
So when did you first get interested in Scientology?
You know, the first time I ever ran into Scientology, I was at school in Tulane in New Orleans. This was back in the late 60s. And I'd lived in an apartment, and below the apartment there was a little storefront, and it was a Church of Scientology mission or something. I went down and met some of them, and they showed me the e-meter, and I held the cans and so on. So, you know, I was curious about it. And, of course, like everybody, I heard about all the movie stars and so on that had passed through Scientology, and I wondered, what's in it for them? You know, what do they get out of it? And I got more curious as the church's reputation became darker, and yet people like Tom Cruise and John Travolta, et cetera, still continued to ally their reputations to an organization that many people in America regard with great suspicion, if not abject fear, if you're some of the former members.
I'm fascinated by this transformation of L. Ron Hubbard from fiction writer, and I didn't know, for instance, that he was a pal of the great Robert Heinlein, to the founder of what is now this multi-billion-dollar religious institution. Talk about his career for some time as a not unsuccessful writer in the 30s and 40s.
You know, as a writer, I kind of have to take my hat off to him because he holds the Guinness Book of World Records for the most number of books published, more than 1,000. And he legendarily wrote 100,000 words a month. In the old days, and when he was in the Pulp Fiction era, he would put a roll of butcher paper into his typewriter platen, and you know, it was a physical action for him. He would perspire. He was writing so quickly, and when he was done, he'd take a T-square and cut it off, and then roll in the next story, and off he went. He was paid a penny a word, like most pulp writers of that era.
So Hubbard's fervid, on all the time imagination comes into play, I guess, when he writes this improbable instant bestseller, Dianetics, in 1950, which I was interested to see that he excerpted in Astounding Science Fiction magazine first.
Right.
Now, explain what Dianetics was, is, and to what degree he seems, in your view, serious about it as a way to understand existence.
Well, he wrote this in a month, a 450-page book. It's a very breezy, hasty work, as you can imagine. But his theory is that there are two minds inside you. There's your analytical, reasonable, rational mind, the mind that is like a computer that's absolutely perfect, remembers everything, is a perfectly calibrated, well-oiled machine. And then there's another mind, and it's called the reactive mind. And it's full of your fears and neuroses, all the things that cause you to behave wrongly or forget things or become ill and so on. These fears, etc., are all caused by what he calls engrams. These are like memories, but they're more profound than that. They, in his opinion, they're actually cellular in nature. And the notion in Dianetics is you flush out all these old memories and that are controlling your behavior, drain them of their emotional affect, and gradually purge your reactive mind until it disappears entirely and you become clear. That's the term that Hubbard coined for that state.
And then he and an apprentice developed this primitive-sounding apparatus to tell if people were clear. It was literally just originally a couple of tin cans connected to a kind of primitive lie detector, right?
Exactly. It's the e-meter. It's one-third of a lie detector. It measures your galvanic skin responses. You know, what typically happens is, you know, your auditor will see the needle move. And he'll say, wait, what's that? And you might think, well, what? I don't know, an image came into my mind. And we'll describe the image. And you might say, well, I see a farmhouse. Well, you know, you have any idea? Look around. You know, what do you see? Well, it looks like, you know, 18th century France. And all the time this is happening, the e-meter is validating this as a real event.
Which is so interesting, again, that this was invented, this whole thing, the e-meter, the religion, rests by a fiction writer, part of whose the rapture that he creates is turning what to me looks like a series of fictions that individuals conjure into apparent reality. It's the kind of ultimate fiction becomes real experiment.
Yeah, in a way, you're right. It's a funny thing. I hadn't thought about it, but you replicate Hubbard's previous existence before he became a religious leader.
As so much of Scientology seems to be the past lives thing, the universe is 70,000 times as old as it actually is. There was this planetary confederation like in Star Wars millions of years ago that included Earth. And yet, for 60 years, intelligent people have become believing adherents. Until they become apostates altogether and leave the church, do they have doubts about some of this stuff?
I'm sure that in Scientology, as in any religion, there are people who are more believers than others. And I think what's important about esoteric or what we might think of as absurd beliefs, it serves a purpose. You know, when you make a declaration that you believe in something that other people think is ridiculous, you step across a line into a community. And there's no, you know, nothing separates that community from the rest of society. There's no language barrier. There's no ethnic barrier. There's nothing except the beliefs that draw a line between that religious community and the rest of society. And the more that group is persecuted for the absurdity of their beliefs, the more solidified in some ways they become.
And with somebody like Ron Hubbard, once the IRS and governments actually are chasing him, his paranoia about governments chasing him becomes validated.
Yeah, and then he chased them back. You know, the most amazing feature of Scientology history in some respects is this thing he called Operation Snow White. And in the 70s, he was so worried about what not just the American government but other world governments had on Scientology. So he designed this operation. He put his wife in charge to infiltrate governments and even newspapers. And so more than 5,000 Scientologists were put into this operation. And it wasn't until the FBI raided Scientology headquarters in 1977 that they discovered the true scale of what was the largest infiltration, certainly of American government, by any power.
No, I found that just amazing. You, in the end, you seem to portray him not exactly as a charlatan, although there are things he is alleged to have said and said over the years that make people think, oh, yeah, he was just a clever cynic in it for the money. But it seems as though, whether out of mental disorder or otherwise, he believed what he was preaching mostly. Is that true, do you think?
You know, here's the way I think about it, Kurt. I do think he had mental problems. And at one point, he wrote to the Veterans Administration asking for psychiatric help. And there's no record he actually got it. But I think that he was trying to heal himself. He was a complicated, charismatic man. I think he was troubled. He was a spellbinding figure, and he was in some ways a little ridiculous. But, you know, give him credit. If he, you know, he wrote more books than you and I will ever have the opportunity to read. He created a religion that somehow survived. And it's a fascinating organization.
And one can also see Scientology as itself, to me, as a kind of retro artifact of the 50s with its sci-fi-ish miracle cure themes. Why has it endured? Why didn't it die off with so many other fads and momentary cultural phenomena of that era?
Well, the central feature is the tax exemption, Kurt, that separated it from a lot of marginal religions that couldn't cross that bar. Secondly, you know, the celebrities, you know, having those people as pitchmen is the most valuable commodity the church has. There's nothing else to substitute for it. You know, the exemplary figure that Hubbard had always wanted to reel in, they finally got with Tom Cruise. But I think it's notable that you don't see the rise of new celebrities going into the church. I think that there's a kind of radioactivity that surrounds it right now that makes it, you know, a bigger consideration for people to publicly declare that they are Scientologists, whether they are or not. And secondly, if they do not come to an accounting of the abuses that innumerable people have talked about, 12 people have told me that they've been beaten by the leader of the Church of Scientology. More than 20 have witnessed it. I know that the law has trouble dealing with this because they are a religion, but it's not going to protect Scientology against its future if it doesn't come to terms with its present.
Larry Wright, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure, Kurt. Thanks for having me.
Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief is out right now. I spoke with Lawrence Wright about Scientology and Hubbard for a lot longer than you just heard, and you can hear more of our conversation at studio360.org. While you're there, why not sign up for our weekly newsletter? It's the simplest way to stay up to date about everything on the program now and in the future.
Now, only seconds old, the exact time and cause of my death was already known.
The 1997 sci-fi movie Gattaca took place in a dystopian future. Every bit of everyday DNA that people leave behind, stray hairs, saliva on a coffee cup, can be analyzed and used against them.
I belong to a new underclass, no longer determined by social status or the color of your skin. We now have discrimination down to a science.
We're not quite there, but Heather Dewey Hagborg thinks we may be on our way. She's a visual artist who incorporates cutting-edge scientific tools into her work. In her latest project, she collects random hairs that she finds in public places and uses the DNA from them to make portrait masks of those anonymous people, people she's never met or seen. How close can she get to the way people really look? We were curious and asked Studio 360's Eric Malinsky to find out.
It's noon on Friday. I'm meeting Heather Dewey Hagborg at Penn Station.
Hey.
Penn Station is my least favorite place to be in New York City. It feels like a giant rat maze. But Heather loves coming here to collect loose hairs and even fingernails.
Jeez, this station looks so clean today. Last time I was here, it was just ripe with material.
I've never been so disappointed that Penn Station isn't disgusting. We lurk around the trash cans and under the seats, and she ends up taking a few hairs from a sink in the ladies' room. I also brought a few hairs of my own. Not my own, but three hairs plucked from the head of Kurt Anderson. She doesn't know they're from Kurt.
Are these all from the same person?
Yeah.
Huh. That's interesting. They must have very dynamic hair.
I can confirm Kurt actually does have dynamic hair. We'll see if she can figure out what his face looks like from three hairs in a Ziploc bag. Heather uses a lab in downtown Brooklyn called GenSpace. It's located in a building that's so grimy and old, it's actually kind of cool. Most of the floors have been reclaimed by artists, except for the seventh floor, which belongs to scientists.
And this looks like a lab to me. Just test tubes and,
yes.
You know, vials and all these machines. I don't know what they do.
It is assuredly a lab, no doubt about it.
GenSpace is an open lab. Anyone can apply for membership. Sometimes Heather wants supervision from the scientists that run the lab, but most of the time she just works on her own, which shows how quickly genetics have progressed in the last decade.
I don't have to be a trained molecular biologist to be able to extract DNA. Mm-hmm. You know, it's more about precisely following a protocol, you know, like really sticking to the recipe.
Yeah, like so, in other words, if you can bake a cake, you can extract DNA.
Exactly.
She takes each hair out with a pair of tweezers.
So what I'm doing is I'm just cutting the tips off of these hairs and putting them in these microfuge tubes.
So the most DNA is in the follicle?
That's correct, because that has cells. So, you know, when you pull out a hair, there's like a little bit of skin stuck to it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we want.
She mixes the hairs with gel and puts the tubes in a vortexer, which shakes them up. It will be hours before the hairs have completely dissolved. Each tube has a primer, which identifies a characteristic like eye color or gender. To complete a portrait, she has to repeat these steps 40 times. So to speed up the process, she asked me to tell our anonymous donor, Kurt Anderson, to swab his cheek and send the sample to the company 23andMe. They sent back a giant block of DNA numbers and letters, which broke down Kurt's ethnicity. Turns out, he's 2% Asian.
The 23andMe profile, they have like a million PCR reactions at once. And mine, we're going to have one PCR reaction.
Heather wrote the computer program which turns that string of DNA numbers and letters into a digital human face. Then she sends a schematic to a 3D printer which makes the mask out of sand and glue. Now remember, she's making portraits of complete strangers based on their DNA. And it made me wonder about the ethics of her project. So I visited Dr. Robert Klitzman, who's the head of the bioethics department at Columbia University.
As a researcher, I couldn't be collecting people's DNA without their knowledge, but as an art piece, I think it's provocative. I should say also at the moment, I don't think you can construct someone's face in 3D at the moment based on their genetics, but over time, within 10, 20 years, you'll be able to determine quite a bit about them.
Geneticists are still trying to figure out what genes make the human face, but they have made a lot of progress in predicting what diseases we might develop. And that's why Dr. Klitzman worries that we might be entering a Gattaca-like future.
The Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, or GINA, was passed by Congress a few years ago. So it's illegal to discriminate for health insurance with genetic information, but not for life insurance, disability insurance, or long-term care insurance.
Genetic discrimination could happen in the courtroom, schools, even relationships. Knowing that information will affect the way that people see us and the choices that we make.
With Huntington's disease, even if there's no treatment, someone may say, well, I want to know if I'm going to die at the age of 50. Maybe I won't have kids if I know I'm going to die at 50. It's not fair to the kids. So this is all coming at us like a tsunami, all this genetic information, and we've not yet begun to think about what it means, what we want to do about it, what we should do about it.
Which is the point of Heather's project. Back at the lab, Kurt's hair finally dissolved into the gel. The last step was to create a bright ladder of DNA stripes.
Many times I've done this and gotten no results at all.
But this batch of hair follicles had fresh chunks of DNA.
So like sample one looks good, five is good. That's the one that you brought.
Oh, good.
The computer created four possible faces based on Kurt's DNA. Heather chose the one that she thought had a spark of life. A few months later, I brought Kurt to see his face.
Hello.
Hi. Are you Heather?
Yes.
Hi, I'm Kurt.
Did the mask look like Kurt? Sort of. I mean, I thought it captured his nose and mouth, but it was definitely not a portrait of him today.
It's the Matt Damon version of me.
It's certainly a younger version. Yeah. Basically, the software generates kind of the 25-year-old you.
Uh-huh.
Because right now I don't have a way of determining age from the genetic samples.
Yeah. It's interesting. I have a life mask made when I was 25. We should compare them.
You're kidding.
No. No, and now, I mean, I have two daughters and no sons, and now I'm thinking, wow, it could be my son. My cloned son.
As she keeps going with this project, she knows that anyone can turn the tables on her.
When I run my hand through my hair on the subway, I have the decision, you know, am I going to shake this hair off of my fingertips and let it fall onto the ground in the subway where someone could potentially take it and learn something about me? Or do I want to get really paranoid about it and start, like, trying not to leave any genetic information behind? So I decide I'm going to donate this hair to whoever might come across and decide to grab it. You'll know that I have a strong likelihood of living to be 100. And a more increased risk of Alzheimer's.
For Studio 360, I'm Eric Molinsky.
And I'm Kurt Anderson. You can see a short video of me encountering my mask for the first time at studio360.org. Heather Dewey Hagborg's exhibition, Stranger Visions, is up all this month in New York City. How do you feel about an artist going around and collecting strangers' DNA? Maybe your DNA. Let us know at studio360.org. Coming up, if you become a pop star when you're barely out of your teens, how do you stay sane? stick with your friends.
Having Oliver and Jamie in the band, having your two closest friends, if you do start going a little bit off the rails, or if you were to just suddenly become someone else slightly, I'm sure that Oliver would just sit me down and have a word.
I'll talk with Romy and Oliver, founders of The XX. That's in just a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Lumosity.com, dedicated to helping people improve memory and attention with neuroscience-based exercises for the brain. It's all at Lumosity.com. And from the car company Scion. For their latest campaign, Scion gave cameras to 5 individuals who turned their passions into a profession. When following your passion, you live for every second to see your dreams become reality. See how they make every second count at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you? Support for the Studio 360 podcast comes from Lumosity. How often do you lose your keys? Your wallet? You can spend hours looking for lost objects or spend 10 minutes a day on Lumosity.com, the personal trainer for your brain. Improve memory and attention with scientifically designed brain games. Visit Lumosity.com now. Support for Studio 360 comes from the Vilcek Foundation, dedicated to raising awareness of immigrant contributions to the arts and sciences, recognizing Richard A. Flavell and Ruslan Medzhitov for their accomplishments in biomedical science, and Yo-Yo Ma in contemporary music. More at vilcek.org.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. 4 years ago, a group of 20-year-olds in South London making quiet, careful electronic music produced, figuratively speaking, a huge noise. They called themselves The XX. Before long, their music was ubiquitous, first in the UK, then in America, on soundtracks, in commercials, sampled by Rihanna. The XX has now released their second album, Coexist, and if anything, it's even more restrained and minimalist than the first. They're on tour in North America, and Oliver Sim and Romy Madley Croft, the band's founders and singers, are here with me now. Oliver and Romy, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you very much.
Hi.
So you guys have known each other since you were 3 years old, is that true?
We went to nursery school together, I guess kindergarten in America, and I don't remember meeting Oliver. We just kind of got pushed together by our parents, I think. They were friends, and yeah, I'm glad that they made us friends.
It's kind of sibling relationship in a way. We know how to wind each other up if we want to, but that doesn't come to that very much. But
yeah, well, Oliver basically feels like my brother. So, I mean, I don't have a time in my life when I don't remember him being there. So it's a nice feeling.
You guys started playing and performing together at 15 or 16 or 17. Back then, did you figure, oh, we'll do this through school like people do and then go off and have our normal jobs?
Yeah, I think there wasn't even too much of an idea. It was just, We both kind of fell in love with music at around 14 and just being really obsessed with bands and going to shows. And then at around 15 and 16, we sort of thought, why not do it ourselves? And we didn't think anyone was going to hear it. You know, it was hard enough to, like, sing in front of each other, let alone an audience.
Really? Was that embarrassing at first to sing in front of them?
Yeah, no, it was. And that kind of led to us doing quite a few cover versions at the beginning and doing sort of things more of in a lighthearted way.
Who did you cover?
Wham, and we covered Pixies and Yeah, and just, you know, choosing songs that we could just reinterpret, and all of a sudden we started writing real songs, I suppose, and then it sort of grew from there.
Well, let's listen to one of the tracks off your new album, Coexist. This is the one called Chained.
I wish you breathing, and I wish you stand. Only for long enough, long enough. It's hard to say
That song is also an example of something you do often in songs, which is sort of playing your best friends have known each other forever, but you sort of play these characters of lovers in a dialogue. Did that just come naturally as you decided, oh, we're going to make music? How did that come to be? Was it uncomfortable?
I'm not quite sure how it happened because, you know, we are obviously just friends and what we do is we just sort of share the songs. Everything Oliver's singing, he's written, and everything I've seen, I've written,
really?
Generally.
Huh.
And we're both sort of talking about different things, focusing our affections on different people or ideas, but usually we manage to make them fit together. But obviously, because it's the two of us singing and, you know, a boy and a girl, I think, and it does sometimes could be that we are singing to each other, that I can see why people think
it could be like R&B lovers.
Yeah,
you know?
And but it's funny, we never thought about it that way and it never was uncomfortable, which is a good thing.
Have you learned how to, like, be show people more than when you began? I mean, you seem like relatively normally introverted people and not like, I'm going to put on a show.
Yeah.
Did you have to figure that out?
Yeah, we've had to force ourselves up on stage. You know, our love was just writing and recording.
Mm-hmm.
And just through, like, relaxing a lot more on stage, we've been able to play with it. And now I do love it. I really do love it. Like, on this month break that we've had for Christmas, I've actually found myself missing it quite a lot. But we're definitely not, like, born for the stage people. I just think we're normal, but
yes.
In comparison with a lot of other people in bands,
right?
We are, you know, Howard Hughes, you know, really just wanting to, like, hide as
stay
much
in your
as
cave,
yeah.
And also, I think that having Oliver and Jamie in the band, having your two closest friends, if you do start going a little bit off the rails, or if you were to just sort of suddenly become someone else slightly, I'm sure that Oliver would just sit me down and have a word. Which is really good, and I think maybe not all people in bands or musicians have that sort of, you know, that a good friend around them to sort of say, what's going on here?
Your music is a big part of remix culture. There are lots of remixes of your songs by other artists and DJs. I want to play one by the Gorillaz of your song Crystallize, which is kind of a meta remix, since after the Gorillaz covered you, it was remixed again by Jay Thunder.
You've applied the pressure to have me crystallized, and you got the faith that I could bring paradise. I'll forgive and forget before I'm paralyzed. Do I have to keep on?
Roma, you'd never heard that?
I heard the Gorillaz cover, but I'd never heard it remixed, cover remixed.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
really cool.
What is it about your music, do you think, that makes it so particularly appealing to other artists to mess around with and play around with?
I guess there's a lot of space in our music, and that kind of space to put your stamp on it. Yeah, but I like it. I love covers. I love hearing them, you know, especially when they're kind of taking it to a very different place. It's exciting.
You also do some covers. Let's listen to a remix you did in 2009 of your pal Florence and the Machine's song You've Got the Love.
Jamie was asked to remix that song for Florence, and he wanted us to sing on the remix, and I thought, how does that make sense? That can't be a Florence cover if Florence isn't singing on the song. But obviously he manipulates her voice in a really amazing way in the chorus. We put performed it live at Glastonbury once with her. She joined us on stage. And
that must have been fun.
It was a lot of fun. It was a very different thing for us, especially at that time, to put down our guitars and stand there, especially next to a performer like her. Yeah, it was definitely nerve-wracking, but it was a lot of fun.
And do you envision, okay, you're 24?
23.
Do you have a sense of, okay, at 30, this is what I want my life and my work to be like?
I don't know what I'm going to be at 30, so I don't know what I'm going to want.
I think we both love the idea of writing songs for other people, and I guess, you know, spending a lot of time writing the songs, creating the music, and then just handing it over to someone else to perform all over the world.
Really? Just sort of have a Tin Pan Alley operation where you're sitting back and writing?
I know I'm always going to write songs. I don't know if I'm always going to want to perform and tour. And this is kind of a way of still being creative.
Well, I hope you at least do it until you're 30. It's really lovely, lovely music you're making.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oliver and Romy, thank you very much. The XX's latest album is called Coexist, and you can find out where and when to see them perform on their endless North American and world tour at studio360.org. Did I And that's it for this hour. Thank you very much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Julia Barton,
Shannon Geis,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Ruth Samuelson.
Our theme music is by David Van Tegum. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Studio 360 Show. And I'm on Twitter at KB Anderson. That's Anderson with an E.
Support for Studio 360 comes from the car company Scion. For their latest campaign, Scion gave cameras to 5 individuals who turned their passions into a profession. When following your passion, you live for every second to see your dreams become reality. See how they make every second count at Scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And from Lumosity.com, dedicated to helping people improve memory and attention with neuroscience-based exercises for the brain. It's all at Lumosity.com. Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, some advice from the country music superstar Dwight Yoakam.
Man can't really steal your field of wheat overnight, but he can sure take a lot of sheep, cattle.
Dwight Yoakam on music, movies, and agriculture. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Well, I'm a honky-tonk man.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.